My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
It's The Breakfast Club, the world's most dangerous morning show.
Hey!
Angela Yee is kind of like the big sister that always pokes you in the forehead.
That's not how it goes?
That's not how anything goes.
Yemi's really like a robot. One of the best DJs ever.
Believe that.
Charlamagne is the wild card.
And I'm about to give somebody the credit they deserve for being stupid.
I know, that's right.
What is wrong with you?
Listen to The Breakfast Club weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on 106.7 The Beat. Columbus's real hip-hop and R&B.
Hi there, I'm Zach Braff.
And I'm Donald Faison.
We're real-life best friends, but we met playing fake-life best friends, Turk and JD, on the sitcom Scrubs.
20 years later, we've decided to rewatch the series one episode at a time and put our memories into a podcast you can listen to at home.
We're going
to
get all our special guest friends like Sarah Chalk, John C. McGinley, Neil Flynn, Judy Reyes.
Show creator Bill Lawrence, editors, writers, and even prop masters will tell us about what inspired the series and how we became a family.
You can listen to the podcast Fake Doctors, Real Friends with Zach and Donald on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Learn the music that matters to you the most with the Musician app. They have so many ways that you can learn guitar, piano, ukulele, or bass, and it's even easier to learn your favorite tunes on those instruments. Please, become the musician you've always wanted to be. Visit musician.com/words to try Musician with a 20% discount using the code WORDS, W-O-R-D-S, obviously. Musician is a great app. Step-by-step process, you really get into the nitty-gritty of learning these instruments, and it is so, so easy. My 7-year-old is learning piano on this, okay? So download Musician today and get 20% off, okay? Use the code WORDS. Listen, this is serious business. If you've ever stopped at a railroad crossing and the signals are flashing, you don't see the train, or it looks like it's moving slow, you're like, yeah, I could probably squeeze in there before the train comes. Think about this. In 2018 alone, 270 people were killed at railroad crossings. 270. That's crazy. So stop and wait, because trains can't. I lived by train tracks for many years of my life, and I always kind of thought that, but you need to be safe. Stop. Trains cannot. Now here's the show. Hello, everybody. How are you? I am Ray Harkins. You are hanging out on this very podcast feed called 100 Words or Less, where we talk to people who are involved in independent music, independent culture. You know, that's mostly specifically focused on music. But, you know, there are many different ways that you can take independent culture, that whole DIY mentality. Like, for example, this morning I was listening to a new episode of the Marc Maron podcast, WTF, which, if you are not a listener of that, you need to rectify that immediately. Not like I'm recommending one of the most popular podcasts of all time. So if you for some reason listen to this show and you've never listened to Marc Maron's show, you will notice a lot of similarities in there. And I've made no bones about the fact that I basically ripped his idea off and are doing this for a more independent music scene. But anyways, the example I'm trying to make, Christina Hendricks, who is a professional actress who's been in Mad Men and a bunch of other crazy stuff. She's very successful. And they start talking about music, and she talks about Sisters of Mercy and Skinny Puppy, and then she talks about Fugazi, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, like that's insane that that was a formative thing in her life. So, but at the same time, it's like these music scenes have existed for 30 plus, 40 plus years now, and it's just incredible. So, but anyways, I digress. The point being, this is very influential stuff. And I have a guest who is very influential on me, is also a very, very good human being. His name is Tim Singer. He's a vocalist from Dead Guy, Kiss It Goodbye, He also did a project called Family Man that I think a demo was posted online, if I'm not mistaken. But Tim Singer, frankly, one of my favorite vocalists of all time. I love everything he has done. And he also played in No Escape. Like, how could I forget that? I have a ridiculously old No Escape shirt myself. But yeah, more about Tim in a minute. I can't even believe that I'm saying that he's on this podcast. But there's exciting stuff afoot. The band Curl Up and Die, who was a very, and still is a very, very important part in my music upbring, because my band Taken, we did a ton of stuff with them as far as touring, and we kind of started it at the same time, and you know, we went off in different paths as far as like signing record labels and tours and all this other stuff, but we did so much together, and those guys became really, really close friends. I toured with them just independently, like as a merch guy, tour manager, hanger outer guy, but it was really, really fun to hear that they are doing a reunion show at Chain Reaction on June 22nd. And Taken is playing the show along with some other great bands like Seizures and Regional Justice Center, who are both previous guests of the of this very podcast. But that show is happening, and if you are in the Southern California area, or even if you're not, come hang out. Tickets are, I mean, this sounds like so stupid, tickets are going fast, like whatever that means, but it's true. Tickets are selling really well. If you want to go, you should buy your tickets now, and don't be bummed when you're like, oh man, I've waited too long, because the show is going to be really, really fun. And I didn't think this was going to happen, but it did, and that's awesome. And I also want to tell you about Rockabilia.com. Use the code PCJabberJaw, and that gets you 10% off your order, whatever you're ordering on there, which is band merch. They know exactly what they're doing with band merch. They ship it to you fast. They have high-quality designs that are all authorized and endorsed by the bands. They get paid. You get cool merch. This awesome independent company stays in business for another 175 years. They've already been around for 30 plus years. They're just a great business. So support the supportive and support them. PC Jabberjaw for 10% off of your order. Thank you very much to the beautiful folks at Rockabilia. What else do I have to tell you about Tim Singer? There isn't much beyond the fact that he's an unbelievable vocalist. He basically really, really channels his anger and rage in like the most palpable way possible, as far as his screaming. It just sounds so tortured. And that's what places him on the top, the Mount Rushmore of my favorite vocalists. You know, it's like him, Chris Callahan, maybe Carl from Earth Crisis, especially when you're talking about like, you know, more independent minded music stuff. Like, you know, I'm not going to compare him to Ian Curtis, because that's a whole different ballgame. But as far as aggressive music is concerned, okay, how about we say that? But yeah, Tim Singer, I spoke to him, gosh, I interviewed him, I want to say, like, I don't know, 15 years ago for a great zine that was happening at the time called Status. My friend Seth Brown did that. If any of you remember Status fanzine, just, oh man, pour one out. Such a good zine. But I interviewed him, and I actually went back in my archives and found the actual hard copy of it to look at the interview questions to see if I like did a terrible job, because I spoke to him for over an hour and we only ended up using, you know, maybe 10, 15 of those questions. But I realized, I'm like, oh man, I had no idea what I was doing back then. Sorry to anybody who I interviewed when I was like 21 years old. But in any event, Tim was very gracious, came on, hung out hard, and this episode is spectacular. So here that is, and I will talk to you after the episode is over. The idea that, you know, I mean, I've told you this before, and, you know, I've blown smoke up your butt before, that, you know, you were definitely, you know, one of my favorite vocalists of all time. And I know this question has been posed to you, but in some fashion, but the, you know, people are clearly listening to, you know, Dead Guy Kiss Goodbye, No Escape, and are just like, dude sounds pissed. Like, every band he's singing sounds pissed. And like, you know, I know this is a very sort of elementary question, but just like, did you always kind of like just tap into like, I am going to yell at the top of my lungs, like I'm always going to, you know, blow myself out or whatever? Or was that something you kind of like, you know, I guess learned how to tap into something? Or was that just always kind of the mode you were in?
Right. I think it's, It's funny. I think it's always been there. It's like, I'm a mellow person. If you know me, and people are sometimes surprised when they hear the music, but I remember running into some friends of mine that I grew up with and telling them like the type of music I was doing. And I think I might've played some, and they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like they sort of got it. Like for me, punk rock was that stuff you listened to alone in your room when, I don't know, you felt like you're the only person who felt the way you feel, and I don't know, nobody gets you, or I don't want to get too melodramatic about it, but like that's the shit I grew up like, I don't know, loving, right? Like, and it's you know, to this day I still love really. I don't really listen to a lot of like quote unquote heavy music. It's more heavy in terms of like mood. Like I just like that. I like heavy movies. I like heavy music. It could be Johnny Cash. It could be PJ Harvey. It could be Black Flag. It could be Laughing Hyenas. Whatever it is, it's like that kind of mood. But it's not a macho thing. I'm not a tough guy. Mm-hmm. So it's I don't know. It's something that's easy for me to tap into when I get into a room with some musicians and we put on some, you know, we create some loud music, and a lot of it was a reaction to, like, you know, I was like a New York hardcore kid, and it became a very cliquey scene. You know, it was almost like there was like a popular crowd, and it, like, none of that made sense to me. And all of a sudden everybody's getting sort of stylish, and it's like style is a really big thing. And I don't know, like instant fame was a big thing, and then rocking out was a big thing. I just was like, I want to go back to like reaching those kids who feel like no one feels the way they feel, like giving them like a soundtrack for that feeling, right? Where you're alone in your room and you're blasting this music and you find some solace because you're not the only person that's crazy. So that's sort of where it comes from.
Yeah, no, that's, I appreciate the articulation, because I think it's, you know, most people, especially when you're talking about, you know, punk or hardcore, I think it's, you know, people are just like, oh yeah, like you're yelling, but like, you know, people like you and I, and obviously all of our peers who have listened to this style of music over time, like there's so much nuance with, you know, screaming, like there's yelling, yeah. and so to like, you know, to an untrained ear, people would just be like, oh yeah, everyone's angry. And it's just like, well, yeah, everyone is expressing an emotion that is akin to it, but like just the actual execution of it, it differs so greatly, you know, just like singing is.
Yeah. And I hated getting lumped in with the guys that like I call them blurry vocals, where it's like, you know, it's like I like that sort of Cookie Monster thing. Like, you know, and you know, I have a lot of friends who don't listen to this music at all. And I just go, yeah, you'd hate it. You'll think I'm screaming my head off, and you know, you'll think I'm insane, and you'll hate it, and your kids will hate it, and they'll think I'm weird. And that's fine. Like, I didn't do this to be Pearl Jam. Right. Yeah, but I hated also getting lumped in with like a lot of this sort of macho, generic, satanic, whatever. Because for me, my heroes were like Henry Rollins. To me, that was just like, he's almost like just singing the blues, but a lot grittier, right? But he pronounced every word. There's actual expression of thought, you know, there's even vulnerability that, you know what I mean? And you know, and like, he didn't throw in fuck every other word just to make something rhyme. So like, you know, I was riffing off of the Fugazis and the Shellacks and the Rollins bands. And I mean, lyrically, that's where, you know, those are sort of my heroes vocally and lyrically, and, you know, Jesus Lizard, or, you know, the list goes on. And it's not, you know, Pantera, Megadeth, Slayer, whatever, you know, even though I think that's a lot of what like my bandmates were into. And I think that's sort of what worked, was this combination of, we were all drawing from different influences, especially Dead Guy, you know, everything from like contemporary sort of noisecore stuff that wasn't even that popular, like the Cows or Today's the Day, like Orgasm and Kill Men. Like, we were sort of pulling from all these places, and I was pulling from my, you know, 80s punk rock heroes sort of world of, you know, suicide. My wife actually, like, after I was doing this for years, my wife was like, you know, you remind me of the guy from Suicidal Tendencies. And I was like, oh my God, it's probably so true, right? Like, institutionalized, like so many of my songs, I think are sort of like that, where I go on these rants, but I'm not trying to be anybody either. It's just like, these are the things that influenced me. This is like when I got into music, I was like, I'm doing this to sort of do my, like, because I've always wanted to do it. And I'm doing it for like the younger me, right? Like what it did for me, when I was like, I don't know, feeling lost or whatever.
Yeah.
And I love being that person or creating that music for someone else, growing up that way.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It just seeps into you, and like, whether or not you're attempting to, you know, call back to that influence, it's like, it just kind of, you know, it just comes out that way. Like this mixture of all the stuff that you have, you know, got into before or whatever. But, you know, kind of putting the focus specifically on you, you know, again, like trying to find sort of simple biographical information about you. I was struggling. I know that you were kind of, you know, you were born and raised in the New Jersey, New York area, or where did you kind of come up?
I was actually born in Holland, but, I was raised in New Jersey from the time I was one, all the way through college, really. Like, I hopped around. I went to a ton of colleges. I was basically majoring in going to shows. So college is like my secondary concern.
Sure.
You know, like, and it's funny because like I went to Westchester, is one of the colleges in Pennsylvania. Took a cell screening class because I wanted to make Grill Biscuits t-shirts. Right. And so like that was my priority with everything. It was like, how can I take a class that's going to help me, you know, lay out a record or do a t-shirt or whatever it was. So yeah, I grew up in Jersey. My older brother, he's 4 years older. His name's Tom. And my stepbrother Dennis, who I did Bowling Point with. I did Bowling Point with Dennis Chang and Tom Rockefeller. And I think a lot of people don't realize Dennis Chang is my stepbrother, who to me is really just my brother. But, yeah, grew up, and I probably got into punk rock in like 1983, probably Dead Kennedys. My brother was playing all this shit in his room, you know, and it really started with Sex Pistols and The Clash. And then I remember Dead Kennedys blowing my mind. That is a 7-inch called Too Drunk to Fuck.
Oh, yeah.
And it just blew my mind. I don't know. It's just like this surf punk and Jello Biafra and all his crazy lyrics. And then, you know, you buy Leopard Meat Jelly Beans and you discover Bad Brains and Black Flag. And then you start going to New York and you discover Bleaker Bob's and Venus Records. I remember running into Gavin Van Vlack when I was probably 16, ran into him at a record store. He was just a bouncer at the time. Like, you know, it felt like there's about 5 punk rock kids, you know, in the world back then. And he's like, you got to buy anything by Exclaim, like anything by, you know, SSD, you know? And so New York was a really cool place back then. So I really felt like, you know, New York is my scene. I grew up in the Jersey suburbs, really. Mm-hmm. But it was like me and my stepbrother and a couple of other misfits would go into the city as much as we possibly could. And we'd go to those big shows at the Ritz, like seeing bands like the Cro-Mags and DOA and Circle Jerks. And then it was April of 96 when I saw, of 86, sorry, when I saw Agnostic Front at CBGB's, and that's when I feel like I discovered like real hardcore.
Sure.
Like the smaller club, you get wiped out. You know, the bands that aren't on the stage that are playing the show are like in the pit when they're not playing the show. And like, I'm in the pit with people like Harley Flanagan and stuff like that. And like, it was a crazy violent pit, but you know, you'd almost like go in almost like a dare and try to survive. And if you landed on the floor, someone would pick you right up. Like it was pretty cool. And yeah, you know, you sort of check out your battle wounds after the show, and you'd be drenched in sweat, and there's nothing quite like it.
That's really cool. It's cool too that you had that, you know, kind of built in communal vibe from not only, you know, once you started going to the city, but that the fact that, you know, you and your brothers were all palling around getting into the same stuff. That's you know, exciting, especially, you know. So were you the youngest of the crew?
Yeah, me and my stepbrother are like 2 months apart, but yeah, I'm the youngest of the crew.
Okay.
And yeah, like you can go to New York and it was just funny. You see somebody else wearing like a punk t-shirt and you sort of gave the head nod, right? Like Compton Square Park and stuff like that. Cause like, yeah, it was like a much smaller tribe back then, you know? And then it was like, Then I saw, then Some Records opened. Like, that was like this phenomenal indie record store, and that became like a hangout for all the bands. I remember seeing Youth at Today open for Reagan Youth at the Danceteria. And like, it was like these freaking tough looking shaved head dudes playing pissed off straight edge music. And it was mind blowing. Nobody knew who they were really. It was like when they were first starting out. And I was like, these guys are fucking cool. And I was nowhere near being straight edge. I just was like, fucking straight edge bands have something going on, because that band is awesome. Right. And so, you know, bought the Can't Close My Eyes 7-inch. I'd see Youth of Today every chance I got. And it's like, it went from seeing them in the CBs with a half full, you know, club to like, by the end, it was like ridiculous.
Yeah.
How packed these used to be, you know?
Yeah. No, that's super cool.
A little bit of my punk rock intro, I guess.
No. Yeah, it's all, and it's all exciting too, because like, you're, you know, I love going through people's, you know, journeys as they got into, you know, aggressive independent music, whatever you want to call it, because it's so, you know, this sounds kind of Pollyanna-ish, but it's like, it's so, it's devoid of context. Like, you're just getting into this stuff because you're just like, wow, this is cool, this is aggressive, and like, you know, you're not really paying attention to, you know, the scene, and like, I mean, you notice right. It, but you're not, like, you're just consuming this stuff, and it's like, it's all exciting, and then, yeah, I just like that lineage. Yeah,
and there's a lack of, like, there isn't this, like, hyper self-awareness that happens today. You know, like, it was just happening, and we weren't stopping to think, like, how cool is it that people are putting on their independent shows, and how cool is it that people put out their own records? It was just what was happening, right? You just discover, like, to me, Alternative Tentacle was just a record, and Discord were just record labels. I wasn't stopping to think, like, how fucking cool is it that Ian MacKay started a record label? Like, it was just, it was what it was. And you sort of step back later and you kind of go, man, that was special. Right. Like, I was there for the birth of Revelation Records. Right. And Jordan Cooper and I have been friends since day one. You know, and just like how, and like, I remember the Gorilla Biscuit demo when I was a freshman in college that came out, and like, I would drive all the way from South Jersey to go see them up playing CBGBs when they were like, you know, an opening act, with just demo songs. You know, but they were just something a little bit different, you know. And, you know, I'd write to Maximum Rock and Roll and hope my letter got printed. And I'd write to bands and they'd write me back, and I'd get demos in the mail. And there's this whole independent world that sought no, I think what was great about it is it didn't seek any attention from this mainstream world that lived above it, right? It had nothing to do with MTV or any of that shit. And today it's just much more complicated. It'd be harder to sort of replicate this, you know?
Oh yeah, definitely.
So I feel really fortunate to have been around, and I feel fortunate that, you know, my father gave me a camera when I was 14 years old. He actually gave all three of me and my two brothers, we all got cameras like for Christmas when I was 14. And, like, that was just sort of luck, because then we started taking pictures at shows, and I have pictures of all this stuff, which is also sort of amazing.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely, it's super cool. What did your parents do for a living? That, because I mean, being born in Holland, I'm going to kind of randomly guess that there was a military background, or was that just random that you were born?
No. My father's Dutch, my mother's German.
Okay,
I'm the youngest of four. My sisters were born over there. Like, well, my parents moved back and forth a lot. Until I was once I was born, they moved back to the States for good, but they split up by the time I was four. So I grew up really, with a single mom, and it was just me and my brother to a huge degree. And then my father came back into the picture when I was like in high school, and like, he worked for Merck. Like, he was like a mechanical engineer.
Got it.
And I used to spend summers touring Europe with him. Basically, like, we'd drive around, in his Red Beetle. It was pretty cool. For a couple of summers in a row, we just drive around, stay camping or staying hotels and visit relatives. So, but yeah, they have nothing. My parents they have no inkling about music. They know that I do it and have done it. I don't think they've ever heard a song, you know, none of that. And I was raised by a single mom who paid no attention. So I was like, we were sort of on our own, You know, like I could disappear for days and no one would care. So that made for good punk rock experience.
Yeah.
Because being able to just be pissed off at the world and then disappear and
sure.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, maybe.
I'm a father of three, and my kids are just growing up so differently. They're like, they can't even begin to relate. It's interesting.
Yeah. No. I was gonna pick on that a little bit later, just in regards to, you know, when you do the whole full circle, like, you know, you're a parent and you've been raised in this subculture and environment, and it's always such an interesting thing where it's like, oh yeah, like, you know, if my parents didn't do these things, then I would have never, you know, gotten exposed to this or whatever. But yeah. And so, like, did you, you know, as you were kind of, you know, building your own identity and, you know, going to, you know, junior high and high school and stuff like that, you know, clearly you had been kind of consumed by music at that point. Like, did you, and kind of, you were joking around a little bit earlier about, you know, going to a million different colleges. Like, did you care about school, or did you have any sort of like, quote unquote, visions for the future about what you wanted to do with your life?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, you know, as, I was pretty much a straight A student up until about 10th grade. Right. And, I lived with my mom, and she did, there's no parenting there. We just sort of were like roommates almost. And I did my, I took care of my shit. I was really good at school. And but she came home one day and said, God is sending me to Pennsylvania. There's a song about that called Riot Stairs. And she just sort of turned my world upside down. My whole world was my friends, and really it was my friends and my own little family outside of my family that I built. And she decided in the middle of 10th grade that she was going to pick up and move to the middle of Pennsylvania for some job. And it was sort of sprung on me. And then next thing I know, I'm living with my father, who now has been living in the States. And I'd never lived with him that I could ever remember, because my parents split when I was so young. So now I'm in a town 10 miles away, don't know anybody. And post Christmas break, middle of 10th grade, I'm the new kid in school. And I was ill-equipped to deal with that, to say the least.
Right.
And I went from being a straight A student to the master of cutting class, so I could get on my bike and bike back to my hometown and hang out with my friends. Cause I didn't really feel a connection to my father, and my, you know, my brother and stepbrother lived there, but I'd never really lived with them either. So it was just like this really, inartful way of thrusting me into this entirely new life. And, that's when I discovered how pissed off I was. That's when I discovered punk rock, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually I grew really close to my brother and stepbrother because of the punk rock sort of connection. And I think they felt just as disrupted by this new weird family dynamic as I did, I think. So we all sort of shared that. But yeah, the funny thing is, like, growing up, I was like, I'm a straight A student. I'm going to go to Dartmouth like my older sister did. Mm-hmm. And live happily ever after. That was my mindset. And I was like, as long as my mom just leaves me alone, then I'll be my shit. And so she sort of threw a monkey wrench in my whole world. And, you know, me being, I think I was 14 or 15 at the time, I just didn't know how to handle it, you know, and I had no one to talk to about it. And so I was just pissed off all the time.
Sure. And, sure. Yeah. Well, cause you don't, yeah. You know, at that time, I mean, it makes total sense. Cause at that time you have no agency. Like the things that you can control are very, very limited. And so when you feel like, you know, the small things you can control, like, you know, whatever, your group of friends, like the time that you do spend away from, you know, your parents and away from school and stuff like that, and then it all gets yanked out from underneath you, you have no choice but to just completely, completely go the opposite direction and push so hard against it. And like you said, just get, you know, mad. So I completely, you know, see why the trajectory of you being like, oh yeah, I care about school, to like, nah, man, you changed this. You changed this on me. Goalposts have moved. Yeah.
Right. It's like, you can look back on it and go, huh. And then in some ways I'm like, well, you know, I'm glad it happened, because I've made records and I've met people all over the country, and, you know, it's been a really interesting life. So yeah, it's one of those, it's just interesting to look back on, right? And you only get your one life, so it's like, that's the track I was on.
That's the way the cookie crumbled. And you know, kind of, sort of on that same tip, the you know, and frankly, just, you know, the era that all of your bands kind of existed in, there is this weird, whether or not you intentionally did it or this was just kind of, you know, like I said, a function of the era that your bands existed in, there's always this, you know, weird air of mystery about you where it's just like, you know, people, you know, like generally speaking, like no one was, you know, talking like bad about you, I guess, reputation wise, but it's just like, you know, people didn't really know, I guess, you know, from a like music listener standpoint, where it's just like, oh, like does this Tim Singer guy just like, you know, like you were saying earlier, where you're just, you know, a pretty quiet dude. You know, so like, I guess, do you kind of notice that sort of like, you know, air of mystery? Like, oh, Tim Singer is just this, you know, this guy that exists and like he yells into a microphone occasionally. And, you know, am I reading way too much into it?
Yeah, it's funny because I hear it from, I've been actually playing with No Escape for the last 2 years. So everything comes full circle. But the only reason I'm doing No Escape is because I'm writing new music, and that makes me really happy. But and we'll play a couple of the old songs. We'll probably play out this year at some point. But yeah, the guitar player for No Escape, Steve-O, is always like, yeah, dude, this guy fucking hates you. And I'm like, I literally don't know who these people are. And I think people, I come across aloof is maybe the best way I could put it. Like, and I've never really cared what people said or thought about me. But I've never really heard it either. Like I do my bands and I've been with the same woman since before I even did a fanzine. You know, she's the mother of my children. She's my wife. I've always had this other, like, I've never been all in as far as like, I'm going to be hardcore Tim 52 weeks a year, get in the van. Like, it was like, but I mean, I took my band super seriously and I was all in, but not into the scene, right? Like, I couldn't be talking about every hardcore band that exists when I go home, when I wake up, when I go to work. Like, that just gets tired for me, you know. Like, I can't be that guy. Like, I wanted a more 360 life, or else I go crazy. Like, tour, like, you know, there's some people who are born for that, or they just like, they live on the road and this is all they do. And that's just never been me. But yeah, it's funny because, you know, I'll hear from someone like, so and so hates you or is pissed at you for something, and I'll have no idea what it's about. And
that's funny.
And like, I don't have any pissing matches with anybody. Like I'm not in this to like out aggro somebody. I'm not like, yeah. So I hear stuff like that and I go, you know, that's too bad. And I'll talk to anybody, you know, it's a funny thing. Like, I love meeting people. I love hearing other people's stories. Yeah. So all this stuff I've heard it, you know, sort of roundabout about me, but, you know, I definitely, it's funny because my guitar player also gives me shit because I don't text back right away and stuff like that. I'm like, dude, I didn't grow up with the fucking cell phone.
Yeah,
not my master.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, it just never will be. And some people like live by that stuff or like live for that interaction. And I didn't try to cultivate it, you know, but you know, I've met a lot of lead singers and I have noticed that I feel like I am a lot more introverted, or just naturally quiet, or I don't seek attention the way a lot of lead singers that I've met do. And I've seen them like, you know, they're on all the time. Like, they're always trying to act like a certain way. Like they go to bed feeling like they're the lead singer of a band and they wake up feeling like they're, and that's never been me. I've always just, you know, I think I've been amazingly lucky to hook up with amazing musicians and they leave me alone to sort of try to write. I have no musical training whatsoever, but they leave me alone to sort of figure out, you know, how am I going to turn this song into a story that, you know, makes sense to me And I think, you know, the trickier the music, the more I tried to make it relatable to a person like me who doesn't write tricky music, you know. And somehow I've always gotten hooked up with really good musicians, which is just luck. And but I've also tried to be like with every band and every song and every record, it's like I've tried to just get more and more honest, more, you know, more open. I don't have an agenda when I write lyrics. I'm not like, we need to have a straight edge song or a not straight edge song, or, you know, and I try not to be reactionary about quote unquote the scene.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Hey, it's Zuko and Kayla from The Wake Up Call. Enjoy your podcast, and when you're done, don't forget about us. We have a radio show. We try to bring a smile to your face every morning.
We also talk to some of the hottest country stars of today, and we like to share some good news with That's What I Like.
Because Lord knows that's hard to find. When you're done podcasting your podcast, listen to us at 92.3 WCOL.
Set your preset on your radio right now, and don't forget you can listen to us online on the iHeartRadio app.
Try to find sort of, if I feel something, I try to figure out what's universal about it, or what angle can I take on it that's sort of that relatable thing. So
sure.
I was out for a long ramble for
No. Questions. No, but well, you hit the nail on the head. I think the 1-2 punch of, like you said, being aloof and then not being the, you know, sort of lead singer stereotype of a person who, you know, is just like, oh yeah, like obviously I'm on the center of stage. Like, look at me, pay attention to me. And yeah, they're definitely, I could see where both of the, you put both of those things together and people are going to assume that just like, oh yeah, he wants to be the mysterious dude or whatever. So yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Hey, our friends in Podcoin are back and they want you to know, you can get paid for listening to this podcast. It's totally crazy, but it works. I've used it. It's great. So download the Podcoin app, and it pays you to listen to podcasts. So real simple review on how it works. You listen to podcasts, and you're in Podcoin while you listen. Then you turn that Podcoin in for gift cards at places like Amazon or Starbucks. Or if you're a good person, you can donate to some charity, which I've done that, but I've also had some coffee too. So download the Podcoin app right now on iPhone or Android and use the code WORDS, WORDS, and you'll get 300 Podcoin just for signing up. And if you listen to enough of this very show on there, or any other show for that matter, you can get a cappuccino at Starbucks or an Amazon gift card. It's great. So listen to this podcast, or like I said, any other podcast, but let's be honest, just listen to this one on Podcoin and sign up with the code WORDS to start earning today. It'll change the way you listen to podcasts. So essentially, just let me buy you coffee via our good friends at Podcoin, okay? Do that now, and I will love you, and they will love you, and it's a mutual love fest, okay? Podcoin, download it today. Use the code WORDS. Now here's the rest of the show.
Your first band experience is like as you started to get, you know, immersed in the scene and going to shows and doing all that stuff. You know, cause Boiling Point was your fanzine, correct? Or was that the first band that you played in?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, just fanzine. We put like 5 issues. Yeah.
Okay. That's what I thought. And like you said, you were attracted to photography at an early age and stuff. And so you kind of, you know, was that kind of like your first step into, I guess, kind of contributing to the scene in a way?
Yeah, I'm trying to think which came first, that or like doing a ton of like band t-shirts. It was probably around the same time. So like I was in Westchester, Pennsylvania, living with my brother and my then girlfriend, now wife, and a rotating cast of, you know, punk rock kids were always around. And my best friend, Tom Rockefeller, who did the zine, I think he lived with me up there for a while. My stepbrother had been going to college in Boston. He sort of started, you know, the Boston scene a little bit. And he's like, I'm doing a zine. And that's why it's called Boiling Point, because it's based on an SSD song. And so he's the impetus. And then he wrote up a ton of questions, and we got up the nerve to talk to a band. I forget who's in the first one. It might have been, I don't know, American Standard and Gorilla Biscuits. I can't remember, but I don't know. The biggest fear was like, God, if I interview somebody and they're a dick, I'm going to be totally disappointed. You know what I mean? Like,
totally.
Because this is punk rock. And I hold punk rock to a higher standard. I'm like, you know, the rest of the world can be full of assholes and you can sell out and whatever, right? And punk rock's a place where you don't do that, right? And that's how I always felt with my bands, too. It's like, I was never concerned about, I don't know, like whether or not we got paid by Victory Records or anything like that, because it's not why I did it. So the zine came out, I don't know exactly what year, it was probably 89. And around the same time, you know, I was taking the silkscreen classes, I just wanted to make my own shirt. So I made my own Slapshot shirt, I made my own side-by-side shirt. I think the side-by-side shirts might have gotten sold at some point. Made my own Gorilla Discus shirt, which is now the super collectible shirt. I saw somebody wearing it at the Alone in the Crowd show, actually.
Oh, nice.
Just last week. But I made that, and I'd wear these shirts to shows. And I remember going to the GB show and talking to Walter. And he's like, can you print some of those up for me? And so that's how that whole thing started. And it was Walter who kept going, move to New York, man, move to New York. So Walter also planted the seed to... Because after Westchester, me and Tammy, my wife, and my stepbrother, and all of Boiling Point, and my wife moved into the Youth of Today apartment while they went on tour. And that was in Williamsburg in like 89. And so that was our intro to really living in New York. And we had access to like all these Youth of Today photos. And we did a Youth of Today interview. And so and they were like a mecca band for us. So that was like... this dream come true type of thing.
Yeah, that's incredible. You were subletting their apartment while they were on tour. That's so good.
Yeah. And I remember taking the subway for the first time because I never took the subway to Brooklyn. Like, I always went to shows in Manhattan, you know? Like, so the subway was, like, sort of terrifying. I remember having to start taking the subway to Brooklyn, and, you know, I remember seeing Harley Flanagan on the subway going, holy shit, you know, stuff like that. And,
yeah.
Yeah, so that's how we first started. And then from doing the zine, you just end up being around bands a ton. And, like, they want you to do their records, and other bands wanted me to do their T-shirts. So I was, like, the T-shirt guy. You know, I was doing T-shirts for everybody.
Yeah, and that kind of...
Like, T-shirts and photos and the zine.
I was just going to interrupt your train of thought, because clearly that, you know, is the roots of, you know, why you got into, you know, design and, you know, the branding. And I mean, even though you had no idea, like, that's what you called it. Sure. Like, you were just being like, oh yeah, I'll make you a T-shirt. Like, I'll make this look cool or whatever. So that's cool. I didn't know. I knew you had any experience with design. I just didn't know the kind of the impetus and the roots of it. And so that's I like that. And so, you know, I mean,
I mean, absolutely. It's funny that, like, I know guys who are around the scene and, you know, you put out records and stuff, and some of us are successful at what we do now. And we're just like, yeah, everything we learned from the scene, because it's like, and we don't relate to people who like plug into this sort of corporate structure stuff. Because it's like, if you need something done, just do it, and you figure it out, and you don't ask permission. It wires you a certain way, and it's pretty cool. So yeah, you get this education, you don't realize you're getting.
Totally. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, that's anytime you're applying to the creative field, whatever that may mean, whether that's, you know, television, movies, painting, like all of that stuff. You know, people that come from the DIY culture of, I mean, it doesn't matter stylistically what you play, but if you come from that idea of like putting on shows and doing stuff, like you said, without permission, I think you have such a leg up on most people who, you know, it's like, oh, I need these pieces of paper in order to tell. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like, it just doesn't, it doesn't make sense in people's brains like ours. But the,
We're just simply not wired that way.
No.
So many people that, like, treat the CEO like royalty, and I'm just like, I just don't understand it. Like, I just cannot relate to it.
Yeah, it's like, treat him like a human being.
I think we're off.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, like, I'm not going to, you know, belabor a lot of points for, you know, each of the bands that you played in, but just kind of, you know, hit on a few things that, you know, I've noticed per se, where it was like, you know, No Escape was, you know, clearly a weird band, because like you said, you were, you know, you clearly were coming from, like, you know, the hardcore scene, and your band, you know, played a lot with other bands of that same ilk, but clearly you didn't sound like it, because you were, you know, kind of going in a little more aggressive route. the, you right. know, it, was it, you know, because the lines were a lot, you know, blurred back then, where it's like, you know, like, and I mean, in the 90s as well, where it's like, you know, you had hardcore bands playing with like emo bands and stuff like that. You know, did you always kind of feel like, you know, No Escape, like as you guys were playing shows and stuff, like you kind of fit in, but you didn't really fit in at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I felt that way with all my bands.
Right.
it's common theme. With No Escape, it's like we toured, and it's funny because like the other bands would be like, oh, man. Like they would really get into what we were doing, I think. You know, like with No Escape, it's like they were a little rockier, but I was still just belligerent, you know, and we were a little bit more like they were like, you know, it was like early Pearl Jam and what the fuck's the other Alice in Chains, like they're really into that shit, so they're sort of leaning a little bit that way, but I would always pull it back the other way with my vocals and everything, so there's always this sort of nice tension there, you know. And my thing was like I loved Quicksand, but they sort of ruined hardcore in the way that all of a sudden, and I don't know where emo came from exactly. To me, emo was like Embrace and Rites of Spring. And that to me was emo, like that sort of summer of 87 when the Discord bands sort of did these emo things. But like, and to go back to the Quicksand thing, because I love Quicksand, but like all this, I just noticed like every band was sort of thinking about getting signed. You know, every band is like sort of trying to get this sort of singer type of guy instead of a hard, like, you know, and I was even getting pressured. I remember like A&R guys saying, telling me when I was a dead guy, like, hey, if you sang more, you know, I'd sign you guys. And I'd be like, if I gave a shit, I'd listen to you. Like, just that fucking pissed me off more, because I'm like, this is so not like, what's happening to this? Like, it was driving me crazy, honestly. And I was like, I just want to get heavier and uglier. You know, so it's like I just wanted to kill more fucking insane, because everybody's starting to fucking rock out. Everybody's starting to tuck their shirts in a little bit, and everybody's growing their hair at the same time. It's just like I just couldn't handle it. I was like, "What?" I was like, "Quicksand was like was fantastic as Quicksand. I didn't need 10 more of them." And I think I'd already lived through like Youth of Today was fantastic. I didn't need 50 more of them. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was just like the scene was starting to really bum me out, because it was such a, there's so much of this like copycat shit going on. And I wanted it to be like, man, you know, all those old flyers I had that I somehow would find and put up in my room. It's like the Minutemen didn't sound like Black Flag, who didn't sound like the Bad Brains, who didn't sound like Social Distortion, et cetera. You know what I mean? Like, I wanted it to be like that. And there, this weird mindset started to happen where it's like everybody's just looking to sort of cash in a weird way. We didn't know what the fuck we sounded like, man. I just was like, I know I don't want to write mosh parts. You know, I know I'm not going to write about the scene or any of that shit. Everything was just getting so incestual. I was like, I'm just going to fucking treat this like I'm cracking open my, I'm going to write about whatever the fuck I want. And, you know, things like Nine Stitches and like, those are literally things that happen. Like, and I'm just going to open this shit up. I'm going to bleed onto paper. And then like, to me, I was almost being like a really, really hardcore version of emo in terms of like my approach to my lyrics. And I had no idea if people would like it or not, you know, like it was definitely not guaranteed that people were going to like fucking Dead Guy. Like we'd be in practice going, do we suck? Like, we don't even know. Right. Like, people didn't know what to do with us, like when we started playing. So, but I think that was the beauty of it. Right. Like that's the beauty of it. It's just, you know, four guys playing what they want to hear, pulling from their influences, and then seeing if the world gives a shit or not is sort of secondary.
Sure. Totally. Well, yeah, especially when you, like you said, you're building up that, that context of where it was you were coming from, and you see all of the, you know, the people that are trying to capitalize on you know, the backs of all these bands that, you know, have worked really hard and just been like, oh yeah, like, yeah, we need to sound like, you said, like Quicksand is an example where it's just like, you know, there's so many, you know, second and third rate ripoffs that, you know, weren't even really necessarily involved in the scene and are trying to like build off that. And I could see where you have the opposite reaction. You just lean into the fact like, yeah, let's get uglier and dirtier. And, you know, you accomplish that.
Right. It's almost like there's going to be white space over here that needs to be filled. Plus, I'm pretty good at this sort of thing. Like, I can't sing like Walter anyway. So it's sort of like, I know what I'm good at lyrically and vocally and what I sort of like what feels real to me when I do it, you know?
Totally. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. So I was like, I want to hear, you know, that's all. And it's funny because like, I remember Walter describing what he wanted to do with Quicksand. He's like, you know, Jane's Addiction meets Fugazi meets sort of hip hop, you know, like, and I was like, that's really cool. You know? And I've known Walter forever. And it's like, you know, his record collection was 1/10, you know, hardcore stuff. And then you're flipping through and it's like B-52s or it's like Buzzcocks or, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, it was all over the place. Like he was pulling from, and that's why Gorilla Biscuits was interesting, right? Because they weren't like the 20th moshcore New York hardcore band.
Absolutely. Totally. Yeah. They're combining a bunch of different, you know, eclectic and exciting influences, and that kind of, you know, spawned out to what it was that they became.
Yeah. Plus their line is phenomenal.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. Like, you can't put together a more, you know, classic players as far as that's concerned.
I was like, shit, you got Alan on drums with Walt. I was like, and Tom Capone. I was like, holy shit. Yeah. Like, it had to be awesome.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course. You know, so as Dead Guy started to, you know, come out and play, and, you know, No Escape obviously was in the rear view from that perspective. You know, Dead Guy was definitely way more active than, you know, No Escape was as far as, you know, touring more and kind of getting your name out there and right. You know, putting more music out there. You know, did you did you feel, I guess, momentum with that band? Like, was it kind of exciting, the things that you guys were getting to do that was a bit, you know, on a larger scale than No Escape? Or did you even have the ability to kind of recognize that as things were happening?
Yeah, it was exciting. It was like No Escape sort of fizzled out, right? I went to Rutgers, they stayed in Philly. Plus, they really wanted me to, and they know this. I'm not talking smack. I'm like, my really good friends, but they wanted to be way more rock. They wanted me to sing like I was, you know, in Pearl Jam or Alice. They really were enamored with that. And I think they've since sort of, they've seen what I've gone on to do without them. And they've since sort of come full circle in a way. We can laugh at that, you know, and I'll always be grateful that it was my first band, and I love a lot of the songs we did, but yeah, they were like, they really wanted to rock out. So it was like, we just parted ways sort of amicably. But it also left me with this thing. I'm like, all right, my next fucking band is going to be full on heavy. And we're going to, and No Escape was a little bit lazy, right? It was our first band. We didn't, you know, I was just happy to do my first band, but that was like a huge hurdle for me. And we didn't, you know, we did one tour and it was awesome, but we weren't like super ambitious. And then Dead Guy, we were like, we're playing every fucking weekend. We'll play anywhere. We'll do anything. Like, we just had that mindset of like, let's just do this. And that was cool, you know, and like, it was just cool to play a lot. Like, I just loved playing a lot. I loved being in a tight band, you know, like I loved when we had Keith Huckins, that was like, the sort of super step that we took. You know, one of my favorite things is band practice. I love band practice. I love making songs, making something out of nothing. It is just, I don't know, there's nothing like it. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of it was like, you know, I think this is sort of how I'm driven a little bit. A lot of it was like, fuck No Escape. Dead Guy's going to work 10 times as hard. We're going to do 10 times as much. I'm going to, you know, put more effort into this and just, I don't know. And sort of prove to myself that, you know, like not every band needs to sound like fucking Alice in Chains, you know, right. Or Quicksand.
Right. you know what I mean? Yeah, totally. But did you know, because clearly, you know, at that time, there were not bands that were, you know, doing this for a quote unquote living. Like, you know, yes, you could point to the right. band, you know, bands in the early 90s where it's just like, oh yeah, like Quicksand and some of that. But then, like, you know, there was, you know, bands that were like touring actively, you know, your Earth Crisis and your, you know, Strife and stuff like that. But like, right. did you ever have, you know, kind of that, I guess, business vision of the band of just like, okay, like, you know, we're going to do this because, you know, over the next, like, you know, 5 years, this is our goal or whatever? Or was it just one of those things that you were just existing kind of, you know, moment to moment as things were coming?
You know, it was moment to moment. The band paid for itself, which was pretty exciting. You know, like, none of us had to dig into our pockets ever for anything, which is awesome. The drummer of Dead Guy definitely, I think, you know, he saw more that this was an opportunity to do something. And I never really thought of it that way. You know, I don't know if that's to my credit or to my dismay, you know, like, it just didn't really enter my mindset. I think I was, you know, sort of a stubborn, I also had the means to make money outside the band. Like, I didn't have like a shit job. I could do like work I liked and make money. So it was, you know, I wasn't like, oh my God, I've got this band or nothing, you know? And
what were you doing? Were you doing design stuff back then?
Yeah. Yeah. I could just freelance and make, you know, decent money, you know? So, I can go on tour, come back, freelance, go on tour, come back, freelance. And I was fine. So I was sort of comfortable in that regard.
And it was, always like the through line was, it was like always design. Like, would you be designing stuff like, you know, for like commercial agencies and stuff like that? Or would you be,
I started doing that more and more. Yeah.
Got it.
I started working at agencies and they'd know me. So I'd be like, and they'd always try to hire me, but I'd be like, yeah, no, cause I'll just end up quitting to go on tour. So,
right. Just do this for me. Know? Yeah. That makes sense.
But, I think it helped us hard to find. So I was able to do that. So yeah, it was never, and like, I was always, you know, I always had the same girlfriend and, you know, so I had this sort of life outside of music. So I wasn't like, oh my God, I got to make this work. This is my one thing that I can do with my life or something. And, you know, some guys that it is that way. You know, I remember talking to like people in New York and they're like, this is all I can do, man. Like I was a kid from the burbs. Like, I went to college, my parents paid for it. You know, like, these bands from New York, a lot of them are like truly blue collar people. Like, they, you know, it's amazing what they've done with their musical careers because they were promised nothing in life. You know, I'm much more like, you know, a semi rich kid from the burbs compared to them. Even though I didn't grow up that way. By the time I graduated high school, you know, my father was back in the States. He worked for a big corporation, you know, paid for my college, that kind of thing. So,
yeah, right.
You know, I wasn't back against the wall, music or nothing kind of mindset ever, you know. And I always just knew too, like, best thing that I've got going, no matter what, was my girlfriend. Like just, I knew she was the one, and we're still together 30 years later.
And, how did you, I have to pick into that because that's did you meet her in high school? Like, are you guys, you know, the proverbial high school sweethearts, or did you meet her through shows?
No, it was college. It was college.
Okay, college, got it.
But I was like 17. It was 87, so I was 18 or 19 when I met her, I forget. But that was it. We just sort of stuck together since then. Like,
that's incredible.
We were living together within a couple of months and then moved to New York together in the Youth of Today apartment.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
And then we lived in Greenpoint, and then we lived in Hell's Kitchen. And the whole time I'm pretty much minoring in college and majoring in punk rock. And she put herself through school. And yeah, I don't know. And I just always knew like that was
the one.
That was the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well,
yeah, I was never that guy that was like, not, so I wasn't like hanging out with hardcore people every night or, you know what I mean? Like, so I think that's also what made me seem aloof, you know, like I was never one of the boys, you know, unless I was on tour, obviously, because then I'm stuck with these guys every day. But
in a world where everyone is confined to their homes, society begins its largest bin watch to date. In the hallowed library of Hulu, or perhaps on a shelf of DVDs you haven't looked at in a decade, is a show that perfectly encapsulates life in the early aughts and launched a friendship that would inspire millions. Hi, I'm Zach Braff.
And I'm Donald Faison.
In 2001, we starred in Scrubs, a sitcom that revealed a glimpse of what it was like to survive a medical internship. As Turk and JD, we explored guy love.
Nearly 20 years later, a lot has changed. We're not supermen, but we're still best friends. Given the mandatory lockdown, there's no better time to relive the series that brought us together in the first place. And we're doing it with a podcast.
That's right, people. We're going to bring friends and crew members and fellow cast members and writers. And guess what? We're going to even invite some of you to call into the podcast and ask all the questions you want of the entire Sacred Heart staff.
Join us for Fake Doctors, Real Friends on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I know. I like that. I like that picture you paint, because I think that, you know, when people feel like they have some sort of semblance of stability, whether it's like, you know, their family's behind them, their, you know, significant other or whatever, you do have the ability to kind of be a little more daring in your creative pursuits, you know, or like you said, where you felt, you know, structurally sound to be like, oh, yeah, dude, I'll just, you know, when I'm home, I'll do some design work or whatever. So it can afford you the opportunities to be, you know, a more, you know, risky in regards to, yeah, the creative pursuit. So I appreciate you laying it out like that. And kind of on that same tip, the idea of, you know, I mean, you toured for years. I mean, not only with Dead Guy Moore, but then, you know, with Kiss It Goodbye as well, where you guys, you know, really hit it as hard as you could. Was your relationship with tour kind of always fraught with the, yeah, I like it, but then I don't like it because I have to be, you know, playing in front of, you know, five people and, you know, driving 12 hours or whatever. Or did you kind of always have a, you know, positive relationship with tour? How did your, I guess, opinion evolve over time?
I always loved it until the obituary tour that Kiss Goodbye did.
Okay. That like broke you.
It sort of did.
Okay.
It sort of did. I didn't want to do it. I wanted Kissing Goodbye. I was like, I want us to be like Helmet. Like, we play Kissing Goodbye shows. We don't try to, or, you know what I mean? I wanted to be like, and I don't care if it's as big, but the band was like, oh my God, it's Obituary. We're going to play to 5,000 people every night and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, all right, well, I got outvoted. Right. And they know this. This is not, I'm not talking about anything that's like secret. They know I didn't want to really do it, but I was like, I'll do it. You know, whatever. I'm up for anything. And the tour sucked. And we got kicked off because I think me and the bass player, like, were talking shit about them, like, very openly. And somebody in the band heard it and then kicked us off the tour. But they were drawing flies. It was 21 and over. Like, I think pretty much every show is 21 and over. You know, half the time you could have fit all the fans into their tour bus. You know, like, it just was like a weird, you know, marriage. And I never liked that kind of music anyway. You know, I was like, shit, man, I'm a fucking punk rock hardcore kid. I was touring with Obituary is not on my list of things to do ever, right? And I think it was Obituary. All these bands are the same to me, but I'm pretty sure it was Obituary. But it was whatever. Like, it seemed like a dream come true for some of my bandmates. I think that basically broke the band. Like, it was the first time my wife said, like, that was the first time she said goodbye to me and sort of had a pit in her stomach because she could tell I wasn't, like, super into it. So it was like, as long as I was into it, like, I could go on these tours, and she was just happy for me. We'd miss each other, but, you know, she's a well-rounded person with her own friends, and she would do plenty of interesting things without me. So, you know, and it got easier because you could actually, after a while, like, calling people. Like, at first, touring was tough, man, because, like, you had to find a payphone, you had to be able to try to call them. Like, that was tough. But, so to me, I'm like, I didn't care about it. Like, to me, playing in front of nobody was never anything. If it was, like, our tour, and you know, we were playing in front of like the right people who appreciate it. You know, and there's always like some town between cities where you play to 12 kids, but like that never bugged me. I mean, obviously you always hope to be there to be more, but my mindset was like, all right, what are we doing? You know, first tour, there'll be 12. Next tour, there'll be 30, because we're going to put on such a fucking show that people are going to lie about having been there. They're going to lie and say, I was at that show when they weren't. Like, that was sort of my goal for every show we played. I wanted to be that band that was, like, so tight and so heavy that, you know, people lied about being there. Like, that the people that were there were, like, felt like, holy shit, I saw something special.
Right.
So, because I saw Rollins in 86. It was his fourth show after Black Flag broke up, and it was just him solo, right? And before it was the Rollins band. And I saw him at this obscure club in Margate, New Jersey. And there might have been 12 of us there that weren't like regulars at the bar. And it was the heaviest, fucking most intense thing I ever saw. And I, you know, I took that, you know, and I've read his books and stuff. I'm a bit of a Henry Rollins junkie.
I'm familiar with his work.
Yeah. But I took that experience going, man, he gave me, you know, I went out of my way to go to that show, and he, you know, and he played as though, and you know, Black Flag, I'm sure, had played to thousands of people, you know, and he played that show like it was like, you know, it didn't affect him one bit, didn't affect the band one bit. And I always kind of kept that in the back of my mind, you know? It was never about the size of a show. It was more about, you know, the first time I got stuck in a weird, like, I don't know. I just, anytime I felt like the machinery was taking over, that's when I sort of had a reaction.
Yeah, you're right. You wanted to check out of it. That is interesting though. Cause the fact that, you know, I'm sure that, you know, because of all the bands you played in and, you know, worked with record labels and, you know, worked with booking agents and did these things that, you know, bands in the music industry do, you know, did you, did you have an adversarial relationship to kind of the business behind the bands, or did you do your best to like remove yourself, or how did you navigate that?
I was not the point person for that stuff because I wasn't super interested in it. And it did make me feel sort of, sometimes it just feels gross, you know, like, you know, there's these promoters, I don't know. They're like cliche promoters, you know, and they're like, you just meet these sort of meatheads sometimes. So I was like, I just never interested in that part of it. The drummer for Dead Guy did most of that kind of stuff.
So you removed yourself, and
I think a lot of times the singer of the band is that guy who does all that point person stuff. So
yep,
you know, another way that I guess, you know, I probably came across a loser. Right. I don't know.
Yeah, you know? people come up
to
you
and show up and play.
Right. Yeah, people come up to you and be like, oh yeah, let's settle for the evening, and you're like, no, that's not me. Just pay someone else, please. I don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, I'll go back to the van and read comics or, you know. I did a ton of interviews, you know, and going full circle for the interview thing, like I would do any interview with any kid. And even if they ask dumb questions, I'd try to give them deep answers because I was that kid. Like when I interviewed Fugazi, I was like shitting my pants. You know what I mean? Like this is Ian MacKaye. I grew up on his shit. And if he's an asshole, I'm going to be so crushed, you know?
Right.
And he was a little guarded at first because like, this was like early Fugazi when everybody was still yelling Minor Threat to him and stuff like that. And you know, I'm sure he had to put up with that to some degree. But once he saw that we were trying to ask cool questions and that we were cool kids and we weren't just trying to, you know, trick him into answering Minor Threat questions, like he was super cool.
Yeah, that's cool. And you wanted to be that for other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, man, if a kid wants to do a fanzine, fuck. You know, give them something to work with.
Right. You
know?
You're like, I get it. I did that for years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
With Kiss Goodbye, I find, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, like you said, you know, the Tour with Obituary kind of, you know, broke you from that perspective. But, you know, Kiss Goodbye, like, it definitely felt like there was more of a, I guess, trajectory for the band. Like, you could easily see, you know, by that time, you know, in the later 90s, you know, bands like, you know, Neurosis and like Relapse had obviously, you know, risen to prominence. And there were a lot of labels that trafficked in the, you know, weird art that you've been creating for some while, for some time in all your bands. And then, you know, I mean, the fact that like Sub Pop was going to put out a 7-inch for you guys and, you know, before you broke up. So I guess, did you feel a different momentum with Kiss It Goodbye, or did it kind of feel similar-ish to, you know, what you kind of experienced with Dead Guy, or was it kind of, you know, one and the same?
By the time we did Kiss It Goodbye, it did feel like we were like veterans. You know what I mean? Like, we'd all done bands, we'd all done tours. So it wasn't completely businesslike, but it was, you know, everybody's more like me at that point, where it was like, we did the band and we all had our own sort of family lives going on to some degree. And, yeah. And bands were like, you know, like the whole machinery for our scene has become more sort of polished and professional in a way. So it did feel like, like everything sort of moved up a notch, I guess, you know, like the budgets for recording and using, you know, getting sound engineers and stuff like that. And, we were way more business. Like, we practiced even more than Dead Guy. Like, we practiced all the time. We lived more for tours and trying to play like the local scene. So there was a little bit of a different vibe, I think. In some ways, less of that sort of punk energy that Dead Guy had. It's funny, like, if I listen back now, I can sort of feel the mood of each band. Like, you know, No Escape's like my first band, and you have to get that out of the way. And Dead Guy was the most sort of experimental, what the fuck are we doing, creating new territory. And then, like, Kiss Goodbye was like, it was like, the best drummer I could imagine, the best bass player I could imagine, the best guitar, like, you know, it's a little more mercenary, you know, and we are a little more, you know, we're just a little bit older and wiser, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah, Death Fixation is the record that people talk to me about by far the most, you know, so like, you know, in retrospect, I think that was the one where we're truly sort of, you know, coming the closest to just creating a new thing, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I mean, I like the trajectory that you, you know, kind of laid out there too, because it's like, you know, of course everybody needs to do a first band, and like, it's very rare where that, like, you know, first project like lasts you for like 20 years, you know? So it's like, you need to have those growth, the logical evolutions of, you know, musically how you're expressing yourself, even though it's all kind of under the, you know, the same premise of, you know, aggressive music. But then, yeah, it's like, by the time you're, you know, your second or third band in, like you said, you have the experience where it's like, okay, I know not to make these glaring mistakes. Like, we're still going to make mistakes, but I know how to like avoid some of the pitfalls from the previous ones.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. You know, and like your first band, like, you have a lyric book from your days of just fantasizing about being in a band, and you have, like, you know, some seriously cheesy lyrics. You know what I mean? Like,
of course.
Because, like, someday I'll be in a band, and I'm, like, writing lyrics to, like, music that doesn't exist, and it's like, yeah, it's just funny, you know, but you just sort of have to do that. It's like having a first date or something, I don't know. Yeah, so to me, there's a natural evolution from one band to the next. I sort of feel like it's funny because Dead Guy, I called up Rev and I was like, hey, I'm doing this band. It's a little bit out, you know, it's not your typical thing, but I knew Jordan for years, and Jordan's like, I'll pass. Because, like, he only knew sort of how to sell the hardcore. He knew how to sell, you know? And then Dead Guy had a ton of success, which led to Kiss Goodbye being on Revelation. And then I think Kiss Goodbye didn't really fit on Revelation. You know, like, we made no sense on that label, and I almost wish we were on something else. It would have made a lot more sense, you know?
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. If you put out records on, you know, Hydra Head or Relapse or anything like that, it's like, stylistically.
Exactly.
Yeah. Stylistically, it would have made a lot more sense. you know, people can see the lineage of the fact of, oh yeah, it's not weird that Kiss It Goodbye released stuff on Rev, but sonically it definitely was, you know, not akin to anything, yeah. anything that they were putting out.
The average Rev kid today, like, you know, they're not a Kiss. I feel like, you can tell me this, to me, I feel like there's people who know me for Tim is No Escape Boiling Point, and then there's people who know me as Tim Dead Guy and Kiss Goodbye, and it's very different. You know, like the dudes from Every Time I Die and bands like that reach out to me, and I don't even know if they know No Escape exists. You know, it's like it's all about Dead Guy and Anything After. It's like I feel like there's this fork in the road as far as the type of people that may have liked me for one. Like, I know people who like think No Escape is the shit, and I don't think they give a shit about Dead Guy,
right?
You know, and vice versa. It's really interesting to me.
Yeah, there is. Well, I mean, I think too, just because I think probably, you know, they're in quicker succession, you know, Dead Guy and kind of Kiss It Goodbye existed in the same ecosystem where there was, you know, less of a shift between, you know, like No Escape existing with a whole different crop of bands. You know, it's like, I think that,
right.
I think generation, I mean, I always try to view, like, you know, independent music in sort of, you know, 4-year spaces where it's like, you know, whatever you'd say generationally speaking to another human, and they would be like, oh yes, from like the son to their daughter or son or whatever, or the but like in hardcore and punk, like it turns over every 4 years. And so I think that that's probably the delineation line between No Escape and Dead Guy, where it was like, oh yeah, those 4 years make a huge difference, you know, even though there wasn't that much time in between the two bands existing. But yeah, that's
right.
It's an interesting train of thought. You know, kind of the two last questions before I let you go was that the common theme amongst most of your kind of creative output, is the fact that, you know, from a musical perspective, like I'm not, you know, picking apart your design work, but the music was always, you know, kind of a bit early, where it was like, you know, No Escape, you know, definitely didn't fit in with the context of, you know, youth crew hardcore. But then, you know, your split with Turning Point is, you know, very high regarded on both Turning Point songs and No Escape songs. But that was at the very tail end of the, you know, the band existing. And, you know, Dead Guy could have made more sense in the late 90s as opposed to, you know, kind of in the mid 90s. And, you know, Kiss It Goodbye probably could have made more sense in the early 2000s or whatever. So I'm sure you have kind of noticed that within the context of your own artistic output, where it's just like, yeah, just, and not even like, yo, I'm cool, I'm like always ahead of the curve, but just like, I always feel like maybe I'm just doing this a few years before everyone's kind of collectively ready.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I've noticed that. It's just funny. Cause like, yeah, all of a sudden, like, you know, I remember when Dillinger Escape Plan was starting and people were like, and they were looking for a singer, and there's a rumor they wanted to ask me to sing for them. And then years later, you know, they're like one of the biggest, you know, they play on Conan and they're like one of these biggest bands in the world. And it's like, I think we definitely are that band. I feel like my fate in this whole thing has been, you know, to be that band's band, to be the band that these bands that are big, like, reference or will wear the t-shirt of, or, you know, like, the, like Jacob from Converge will like name drop me on Instagram, you know? And I'm like, you know, like at one point you're like doing my best Tim Singer. Right. And I'm like, and then I look at how many fucking followers he had and I'm like, holy fuck.
Right. You know what I mean? Right.
You know? And he's like, he's an awesome dude. Like, he's actually putting out the Proxys Black, for demo project thing. But, yeah, I'm like, it's like, you know, clearly I didn't have a crystal ball. I think we were just doing our own thing. And, you know, I'm super proud of that. And it's like, I'm proud that these bands that have gone on to like, it's a weird sort of confirmation of what we were doing, I guess. But I was never seeking commercial success, and I certainly didn't expect like this stuff to be as commercial as it is. Like, it's sort of crazy. You know, like, I did guest vocals on the last Every Time I Die, that Low Teens record, right? Because I became, through Instagram, I became buddies with a couple of the guys in the band, and then me and the singer started trading some emails. He shared with me what the song was about. I shared with him. Like, we had some similar intense experiences around parenting, actually, and stuff like that. So I could really tap into this one song, and they sort of helped me crawl out from under my rock and get back into the studio and sort of get excited about making music again. But it's like, I was like visiting a friend in San Francisco. His daughter's like, you're on the same record as the guy, Panic at the Disco, right? Like, cause he does guest vocals on that.
Yep.
And it's like blowing her mind. She's like, holy shit, who are you? You know? And, yeah, it's just weird that this stuff has reached such a wide, you know, like when Low Teens came out, it's like, I think I went to Best Buy and saw like posters for it, you know? And when I was showing, you know, my kids, like, yeah, I'm doing guest vocals on this record. And I pulled it up on Spotify and how many followers they had. My kids were like, who are you? You know, like, it's just bizarre.
Yeah.
Like,
so,
like, this widespread success. And I think it's still a little bit under the radar. It's not like they're on mainstream radio, but,
no, because, but I do think, yeah.
It caught me completely by surprise, you know? Like, I always knew bands can make a living. Like, I always knew the Neurosis thing was out there, right? Like, if I wanted to live like Neurosis, I always knew that was a possibility, right? Like, just tour all the time, you know, and live out of your van or, you know, whatever. I knew that was, like, I was pretty sure, you know, Dead Guy or Kiss Goodbye could have pulled that off. I wasn't really interested in spending, you know, 200 days of the year with my bandmates, in all honesty. And I don't think I was the only one, you know. I think that's what it takes.
Yeah. But, well, I think too, with the kind of, you know, the fact that this aggressive music has now existed in the, you know, culture and pop culture, spectrum now for, you know, 30 plus years, that the people who have been, you know, creating this for, you know, many, many years, whether it's playing in bands or whatever. Now, the fact that they are of an age where it's like, you know, most of these people are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and, you know, have like jobs that can influence culture, whether it's like, you know, whatever, doing art, doing, you know, being creative in different ways. And they're all coming from the same space. It's like, yeah, it's only going to, you know, grow larger. But again, always, always going to be that undercurrent of like, oh, yeah, this is stuff is never going to be played in the radio, but it's going to be. It can be reasonably popular. Like, yeah, people can play to, you know, 3,000-4,000 people a night. And like, that's what happens. And, you know, but yeah, when you were existing and touring, it's like, no, there's no way. Like, Kiss Goodbye could play in front of 3,000 people collectively over a year, maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, our highlight was like, I think we played to a couple of thousand when we toured with The Unseen, and they had just come off of touring with Slayer. So we played this really big space in LA. And it was packed. And that was probably the biggest show I ever played. And it was awesome. Like,
yeah.
It was awesome and it's sort of weird, right? Because I was like, holy shit, like, I can't even see the people in the back. Like, it's weird.
Right.
Right? And I'm like, what do I look like up here? I look like a tiny little thing. And I'm not running around like, you know, I'm not Iggy Pop on stage. I'm not like a, you know, I just sort of plant my feet and get into it. And yeah, it's like, it's sort of crazy, you know?
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. Yeah, it's weird when you're in it.
Like, now I see pictures of fucking, even Sick of It All or whoever, Cro-Mags, all these bands, like they play these South American things and it's like insane. Yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
Well, the last thing I want to hit on was the fact, like you mentioned earlier, I mean, you know, been with your significant other for many, many years. You're, you know, a family man. You know, you do design work. You obviously still play, you know, in musical projects and stuff like that. You know, the undercurrent of you still being, you know, interested in playing, like, you know, you playing with No Escape and doing Process Black stuff. Does that itch just always kind of exist of like, oh yes, like I'm always want to be involved with this, you know, even if it's me not going to, you know, 100 shows a year, this is still an incredibly important part of my life. And I guess what kind of keeps you connected to that in a way?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, it's just still in there. I think, you know, a lot of ways you're still the same, you know, like I haven't changed all that much from being a teenager. And, you know, the world in a lot of ways, sadly proves you right. You know, like, you know, my first real job when I was a Dead Guy, I was like, okay, all the shit I thought about corporate motherfuckers is true. Right. And everything I think about. So all these, I don't know, all the, you almost get more pissed off the older you get in some ways. And then you have offspring and you get sort of pissed off for them, and pissed off is too easy of a term, but I don't know, there's no shortage of things for me to sort of
expand on. And it's just, what's really interesting is getting into a room with guys and we like we're writing music and the songs sort of happen, right? Like lyrically, they just sort of happen, you know? And I think I've gotten into a space where I don't come there with like pre-written lyrics, like ideas for lyrics maybe. And then it just comes out of me. So I don't even know. It's like, at this point, it's just in my DNA. And I don't know, it's something, it's like, this is the kind of artistic expression I like, whether it's music or movies or whatever. Like, I like these things that tap into these darknesses, that recognize them, that sort of kick the stones up to see what's underneath. Like, I just like all that kind of shit. And in some ways, the world's gotten worse, right? I mean, we don't have to get into obvious politics, but the world's fucking
a garbage fire. Like,
it's surprisingly bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, holy fuck, surprisingly bad. I mean, when that motherfucker took over the White House, like my daughter was she was like sobbing, you know, and I think I felt sick for like weeks, you know. So, and it's funny because like even touring, like just like the shit you see, the racism and everything else you see on tour with like when you get out of your bubble, because New York's a bubble. And the New York area is a bubble in a lot of ways, where you just like this multicultural mix of people and exchange of ideas and stuff. I don't know. I guess the more sort of you actually see the world for what it is, you just go, holy shit. So I think there's that to tap into. And yeah, I don't know. It's just always, I've stopped trying to like, it's funny because it's like I don't walk around all day kicking my, you know, staring at my feet and being morbid and dressing in black or something. There's a balance to it, but it's like when I do this, that's what it's for, you know. And I found that I still have it, basically, right? Like a couple of opportunities, like, you know, the Process Black thing with Aaron Edge just sort of gave me this music to listen to and asked if I could put vocals over it. I found it super difficult because I wasn't part of the songwriting process. That's why I had to stop. It was not that organic thing. But, you know, I'm in No Escape. I think we played some reunion show for something. I did it just to see how it would feel. And, you know, and I found that I still have an interest and I still love it and I still sound good. And yeah, but now there's like zero agenda. Like, you know, we practice quite a bit. We've written 6 new songs, No Escape has. And I'm laying down vocals for like the final 3, and who knows who's going to put it out. I don't really necessarily care. But I just like making music. Like, you know, you make a song that didn't used to exist. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's cool. Cause it's like the, you know, part of the beauty of the, you know, internet and ease of access is the fact that, you know, so many of these bands from whatever eras can exist in a space in which it's like, yeah, there's like literally no pressure. Like no band needs to break up anymore. No, I mean, people can right. like, you know, people can like not tour, but it's like, that's fine. Like, but you can still put out yeah. music if you feel the compulsion to, and like, it is a special place to exist in, to just be like, oh yeah, I got whatever. Like if we, you know, No Escape finishes our record, we want to put it up on Bandcamp tomorrow. Like we can do that. And that's cool. And then the people that will know about it, like, you know, those are the people who've done the research on it or whatever. So it's, I get what you're talking about though. It's just exciting to be able to still, I guess, kind of contribute and feel that feeling of what it's like to be creative in a different area.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. It's like of all the things I've done over the last 30 years, like it's pretty fucking cool that like people have been listening to your music and like embracing it or making it part of their life. Like, cause people reach out to me constantly. Like I get random emails or DMs or whatever. And I always respond back. And that's just cool. Like there's nothing else quite like that, where something that you created has an effect on somebody that you've never met. It could be across the planet, you know. There's something just magical about that. It's pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tim, thank you so much for hanging out, dude. This was enjoyable for me, and you know, I hope it was enjoyable for you in some capacity.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, and one more side note. So I had back surgery almost like a week and a half ago, right?
Sure.
And I'm fine. It's like it was over. This nerve has been pinching me, and so I finally got the surgery, and I feel fantastic. It's nothing morbid or sad or anything.
Good.
But I was in the hospital hanging out with my wife, and this guy texts me, and he's like, "You gotta listen to this." And it was your podcast, and it's the one where you guys come up with these dream bands.
Yeah, the fantasy draft, right?
So yeah. It was me saying it, which was thank you for that, which is surreal.
My pleasure.
So it's just funny because I'm sitting here in like a hospital gown, waiting for my surgeon to show up. And I'm just listening to your podcast, and my wife's like, "What the hell are you listening to?" I'm waiting for the part where he says, "I don't know, this guy told me I had to listen to this, and it's Ray's podcast."
Yeah.
And then, like, yeah, so that was cool. That was like, and then, you know, an hour later, they're putting me under it, but it's.
Hey man, it's great. You're perfect in my fantasy draft, and I'm very glad I was able to draft you and no one else stole you. So it worked out perfectly.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was Tim Singer. Thank you very much, Tim, for coming on the show. It's so cool to be able to speak to people whose music I've listened to and appreciated for such a long time. And, you know, Tim and I we're professional acquaintances, but I still feel really cool myself to be able to talk to him on this medium. So thank you very much, Tim. That's a long-winded way of me saying that. What do we have next week? We actually have, speaking of Curl Up and Die, which is, that awesome thing that's happening in June 22nd at Chain Reaction. I have my friend Mike Minnick, who's the vocalist of the band. We talk about that reunion. We talk about his methodology for getting it together, his feelings on it, and just a bunch of other stuff. Because, you know, frankly, both Curl Up and I and Taken exist in the sort of like, you know, reunion ecosystem, not in ways that, you know, other bands exist because both of our bands are relatively small, all things considered. But we had a real, real fun chat, and I just wanted to make sure that he had the space in order to kind of express that, in a long form way, because, you know, people will make a million assumptions about why bands get back together. So I wanted to have Mike on. So that's what we're doing next week. Okay. Have you always wanted to learn how to play a musical instrument? I have to say thank you to Musician. It is the best way to learn, practice, and master an instrument. It listens to you play and gives you feedback in real time on your accuracy and your timing. Visit musician.com/words to try Musician with a 20% discount using the code WORDS. I love this app so much. Here's the good news. The number of collisions involving a train at railway crossings is down 83% from its peak in the 1970s. Here's the bad news. There are still more than 2,000 incidents in a year. Like I said, please just stop when you are near the train tracks. Trains cannot, okay? Please, be safe.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com.
Hi, I'm Esther Dean. I've made my life by writing songs like Fireworks by Katy Perry, Super Bass by Nicki Minaj, What's My Name by Rihanna, just to name a few. And now I'm having an absolute blast sharing some of the knowledge that I've learned with upcoming songwriters on Songland on NBC. I'm excited to welcome you to a brand new season of Songland and Songland's podcast, giving you new insight into the magical art of songwriting, as told by some of the best in the business, and also the pioneers and the up-and-comers who will be shaping the hits you'll be listening to for years. We have an amazing roster of talent this season. I promise you, you don't want to miss one single episode. Don't miss Songland, Monday nights at 10, 9 Central, and join us here on Songland's podcast, available every week after the show on the iHeart app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.